Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Aquarium. I'm Jerry Schubel, president of the Aquarium. It's great to see all of you here this evening. I want to acknowledge our lecture series sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, and I hope that all of you will join me in turning off your phones or silencing them and try to refrain from texting, twittering, tweeting, whatever it is that people do when the lights go off. Tonight, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Bruce Robison. He's going to discuss recent discoveries using both manned and unmanned submersibles to explore midwaters and deep waters of the Pacific. Bruce is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and he's a fellow of the California Academy of Sciences. In 2002, he received the Marine Technology Society's Lockheed Martin Award for Ocean Science and Engineering. In 2007, he was a resident scholar at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center in Italy. In 2009, he received the Ed Ricketts Memorial Award for Lifetime Achievement in the field of marine science. And in 2012, he was appointed as a research associate at the Smithsonian Institution. He grew up in Southern California, went off to Indiana to go to Purdue University to study engineering and to swim competitively. He wondered why anybody could live in the Midwest. He got his master's degree at William & Mary, didn't think the East Coast was any better than the Midwest, couldn't wait to get back to California, got a PhD from Stanford. He is the research division chair at MABARI, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, a remarkable institution that was created by David Packard of Hewlett-Packard, and his dream was to create an institution, a different kind of an oceanographic institution, where scientists and engineers would work together and find new ways to observe, to explore, and create new windows into the ocean. And I think they have succeeded beyond what David Packard's expectations could ever have been, although he was a pretty demanding guy, so maybe I'm wrong. Bruce studies the biology and the ecology of the animals that inhabit the midwaters and the deep ocean. It's the largest ecosystem on Earth, and he's pioneered the use of undersea vehicles for these studies, and he was the leader of the first team of scientists that were trained as research submersible pilots. He was here recently and was a major contributor to a forum that was held at this aquarium on the future of ocean exploration. And he is a very well-known, distinguished ocean explorer, and he certainly helped shape that future. Please join me in welcoming Bruce Robison.
Thank you, Jerry. We'll see if you guys still feel that way when I'm done. All right, as Jerry mentioned, my research concerns the animals that live in the oceanic water column, the midwaters, everywhere between the surface of the ocean and the bottom of the ocean. So let's get started. You already know that. This is a handy reference point. This is one you're familiar with. This may be not. If we look at all of the living space on Earth and include the deep sea floor and all of the land habitat, it'll fit in that yellow triangle. All of the rest of this area represents the living space represented by the oceanic water column on a global basis. Another way to look at it is this way. If we take all of the seafloor of the Earth, the area of all the seafloor, and multiply it by 1,000 meters in order to give it a volume, you get a volume like this rectangle. And if you take all of the land, the dry land on Earth, and multiply it, better once now, multiply it by 1,000 to get it into a volumetric form, you get that little green box at the top. But this shape represents the volume of living space the oceanic water column. Again, it's a huge, huge living space, the biggest on Earth, and not surprisingly, it's home to the largest animal communities on the planet. The biodiversity, the number of individual animals, the biomass dominate everything else on the planet. And it's not a remote, separate entity from us. Much of the food that we eat depends on the animals that live in this deep sea water column. In many respects, the animals that comprise these enormous communities are the Earth's biological flywheel. Their biomass, their energetics are so important to the ecology of the Earth that while we're just beginning to understand it, we had better be careful in the ways that we tamper with it. I work in Monterey Bay. MABARI, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, is located at Moss Landing, which happens to be at the head of the Monterey Submarine Canyon, an enormous canyon in the deep sea floor. It's the same size and scale as the Grand Canyon in Arizona, but it's full of water, so it's very difficult to appreciate with regard to its extent. The great value here is that the canyon brings deep water very, very close to shore, and we can get out there in a matter of a few hours. My principal research station is only an hour and a half away from the dock. That means that we can do what is unheard of for deep sea biologists elsewhere in the world. I can sleep in my own bed at night, go down to the dock in the morning, get on the ship at 7 o'clock, go out, have a full day's diving in the deep canyon, and go home for dinner. I have a friend who, like me, grew up the old-fashioned way. He says, that's not really deep-sea science. If you're doing deep-sea science, you gotta go to sea for at least a month and never change your socks once. This is a more genteel approach, and it works very well because it allows us to collect deep-sea animals to bring them back to the laboratory in excellent condition. We've learned a great deal because we have this ready access. Well, for the folks who didn't change their socks, most of today's deep sea biologists consider the voyage of the Challenger to be the founding event that led to modern day deep sea research. The Challenger expedition put to lie the belief that the deep ocean was devoid of life. The Challenger in the 19th century used equipment like nets that they dragged behind the ship on long hawsers, ropes. They collected the animals and brought them back to the surface in order to study them. Most deep sea biologists in the world today either still collect material that same way by dragging nets, or like me, they began their careers in that fashion and have subsequently transitioned to newer forms. The fact that for more than a century we had only one real way to sample the deep sea shaped our perception of it in some very profound ways, and I'll speak to them in a moment. One result of dragging a net through the water is this is what you typically catch. A bunch of skinned fish. Nets like these are very effective for catching certain kinds of animals, and don't get me wrong, that approach to sampling and studying the deep sea has taken us a great distance down the road towards understanding what's going on, but it had its limits, and I, for one, began to be concerned that I was trying to describe an ecosystem that I had only sampled indirectly. I was always stuck at the surface, reaching down, blindly into the deep sea, hauling up whatever I could catch in my net. And then, assuming that was adequate, I would begin to imagine or to discern patterns and then try to understand what was going on. But some little voice in my head said, what self-respecting desert ecologist or forest ecologist would presume to tell us how forest and desert ecosystems work without ever having been there? And so I began a quest to get into that habitat myself, to see things with my own eyes. There were very, very few means available. There were deep diving submersibles like Alvin, but Alvin is really an elevator. It's meant to work on the seafloor. It rides a big steel plate that carries it in a hurry down to the seafloor. Then it drops the plate, drives around on the seafloor, then drops another steel plate that rises back to the surface. You can't stop in midwater and look around. So I worked with a group of other scientists, and we gained access to a unique suite of one-person submersibles, tiny little vehicles like this one. This is my favorite. This is Deep Rover. Essentially, you sit inside an acrylic sphere with panoramic views all around you. It flies like an underwater helicopter. And once you get past the fact of thinking, I've never had this much fun in my whole life, you begin to look out the window and to understand patterns and to see what's going on. And for all of us who trained and learned to use this as an observational and experimental tool, the thing we kept repeating, dive after dive after dive, was I had no idea that that's what it actually looked like. Because all we had to go on was what we could drag up with a net. Well, subsequently, I moved to Mabari. And David Packard's admonition to us was that I don't think you should be going down yourselves. Human-occupied submersibles have reached a plateau in their technology. But robotic systems have a great deal that can develop. That technology is ripe for advancement. And so he encouraged us to focus on robotic systems. And now we use remotely operated vehicles, ROVs. Submersibles, in every respect except there's no person inside. We're at the surface in the control room on the ship, flying the vehicle, running the cameras, running the samplers, and we have incredible visibility with high-definition videos. Here's Ventana, one of the vehicles that we use, and as you can see, it's loaded with instruments and tools and samplers and cameras. It's an extraordinary platform. Each lab group has its own tool sled with specialized tools and instruments for each lab group's particular needs. The geologists have one tool sled, the midwater biologists have another. And when we get back from a dive, they pick up the vehicle, slide out the tool sled that was used that day, slide in the new tool sled underneath, drop the vehicle down, reattach it hydraulically, mechanically, and electronically, and away you go. This is a demonstration of one of the capture devices we use. This is a cylinder, and the pilot just flies it over the animal. And they're collected with no stress, no trauma. We can make observations with the animals undisturbed. We can collect them, and often the animals don't even know they've been collected. Now, part of our quest is to understand the communities, the systems, the ecological systems in oceanic midwaters. What different kinds of animals are there? How many of them are there? How are they put together into functional ecological units? One of the principal things we learned, one of the most striking observations that we made again and again as we began these kinds of dives, was that the gelatinous animals, animals were so much more abundant, so much more important than we could ever have imagined when all we had to work with was net tubs, because nets are mechanically abrasive to soft, delicate, diaphanous, gelatinous animals. For the most part, we were shredding them into so much mush, and all we would get would be goo. Indistinguishable goo. Typically, when we'd have a net tow, we'd get the net up on deck, we'd pull up the cod end, we'd disconnect it, pour the sample catch out into a bucket, and then scrape the goo off the top so we could get at the animals. Little realizing that that goo that was in our way, in many respects, were the dominant life forms at those depths. It wasn't until we could go down and see them with our own eyes that we realized how hugely important gelatinous animals are. We began to learn about them. For example, medusae are among the most abundant of the gelatinous animals in midwater. They are all invariably predators, at least so far. But we discovered that there are different lifestyles. Some of them, like the solmissus, are active predators. They pulse through the water with some of their tentacles forward in front of the bell, so that the bow wave of the bell doesn't reach out. And so those tentacles are probing for prey out there that are unaware of the approach of the medusa. Other medusae, like this Crossota, put out enormous clouds of tentacles, and they sit and wait for other animals to swim into that cloud of tentacles, and that's how they capture them. So we see there are two different ways that medusae or jellyfish can make a living: sit and wait predators and actively hunting predators. Another group of animals that still confounds us is a paradoxical group called siphonophores. Siphonophores look like big long ropes. But in fact, they are colonial animals. Colonial in the same way that ant colonies and bee colonies are colonial. That's a long chain of individual animals. Each individual has a specific body shape and configuration and a specific role within the community to perform. One group up here that you can't... Oh, I didn't mean to do that. There. Don't look at the laser. Up there is a group of individuals that are swimming bells, and they propel a colony through the water. Just behind them is another group that's a reproductive unit. Individuals produce more individuals. The long chain is a sequence of stomachs, prey capture units, and finger-like organs called palpons that take the food from the tentacle and stuff it in the stomach. Unlike ant colonies and bee colonies, each individual in this chain is connected to all the others, and they share food through a common tube. Here's a siphonophore. This is prey. It has just two swimming bells. But you can see the long, long chain of individuals. This is principally stomachs, tentacles. There are armored units that protect it. But these things get huge. We've measured them 150 feet long. Just extraordinary. Again, you tow a net through there, and on a big net, your mouth opening might be 10 feet across. Well, you only get 10 feet of that 150 feet. No way to appreciate the size and ecological impact of a predator like this. Another group of gelatinous predators are the tenophores, or the comb jellies. Many of them are extraordinarily beautiful and very delicate. They propel themselves using fused bands of cilia. You can see those rippling rainbows. That's its propulsion unit. Like many of the other gelatinous predators, the medusae and the siphonophores, tenophores eat other gelatinous animals. And indeed, that brought us to one of the big puzzles we'll get to in a minute. another group of, let's see if this works. No. Okay, we'll just go with one live one. Another group of important gelatinous animals are the larvaceae. Nope. All right, no moving. These animals are filter feeders. They're not predators. They feed on small particles that are prevalent throughout the water column. Has a mind of its own. Larvaceans build what we call houses because they live within them. They want to filter the particles out of the water, and so they construct an outer structure. And this one is as big as a meter across. They're huge. And then inside, there's a fine mesh inner filter. The outer filter is coarse mesh. It keeps the big chunks out. The inner filter is fine mesh, and that's what it uses to pull the particles of appropriate size for it to feed on. The filters themselves are remarkable examples of natural engineering. You can see the internal structure put there. And that's very complicated. And what's even more amazing is that they build these colossal, complex structures. And then when the filters become clogged, the animal just swims off, builds a new one. An average of one a day. When that filter structure, when the house is abandoned, it collapses in on itself and sinks rapidly to the deep sea floor, carrying all that nutrition. They sink very rapidly, too fast to be degraded by the bacteria in the water. And it turns out that these discarded feeding structures, these abandoned houses, are a principal source of food for animals on the deep sea floor. So when we started putting together pictures of what we were learning about the gelatinous animals, we realized that they comprise a jelly web within the food web that we already knew about, and that this represented maybe as much as a third of all the biomass in the ocean, and that we, frankly, had missed it. We were unaware of it. It's ecologically complex. It's intellectually challenging. Figuring all this stuff out has been a fascinating challenge, and we're only partway there. But one of the biggest discoveries we made when we started going into the ocean directly and seeing things with our own eyes was that it was very different than what the nets told us, and that gelatinous animals were far, far more important than anyone had ever imagined. Okay. Now, this is the kind of animal we caught with nets. They were invariably dead, so we never got to watch them. But we were able to learn a great deal more about them once we started going into their habitat, not the least of which is that light and vision are extremely important throughout the oceanic water column, even though sunlight, visible to you and me, is gone by about 200 meters. The average depth of the ocean, 4,000 meters. By the time you get down 200 meters, our eyes are essentially out of business. We know that the very last photon of sunlight is gone by 800 or 1,000 meters, even in the clearest tropical oceans. So while you might think of this as a dark and forbidding habitat, it turns out that light and vision are extremely important even past where sunlight can reach. For example, this is the dragonfish. This is Idiocanthus, and it uses bioluminescence, light that it makes itself, for a number of uses. Here, in this barbel hanging below its chin, is a luminous lure that flashes this on and off, and it looks like a little shrimp or a little copepod, and it will attract the predators of those animals it's trying to mimic, and it'll snap them up with its mouth. Incidentally, those teeth are really cool. They fold backwards toward the gullet. They won't go forward. Once you start in, you're not coming out. It's like one of those finger puzzles. Males and females can tell each other apart down in the dark because females have really big subocular organs, light organs below their eyes. And the males have little tiny ones. So there's a sexual discrimination there, sexual dimorphism, and that's how males and females can tell each other apart in the dark. We also know that these animals have luminous organs on the back and along the flanks, embedded within a gelatinous sheath that surrounds the animal. And it can turn on those lights and outline its silhouette. So that, again, it can say, I'm a dragonfish. And then finally, all of these light organs along the ventral surface protect it from predators. We've learned that most of the sighted predators, most of the fishes and squids and other animals that are predators and use vision to capture prey, find their prey during the daytime by looking upwards and seeing the silhouette or the shadow of their prey against the lighted waters above. Well, these fish can erase their silhouette. They can produce light with the light organs along their bellies that exactly matches the wavelength and intensity of light coming down around them, and their shadow just disappears. This is an anglerfish, one of maybe the first video footage ever taken of an anglerfish in situ. You can see that it's pitching its fishing rod forward. Here is a luminous lure at the end of that fishing rod, and in the dark it turns that light on and off to seductively attract prey. And then it opens its huge mouth and sucks the prey in. This is one of our favorite animals. This is Vampyrotuthis infernalis. It's a true living fossil. It's a cephalopod. But it represents the cephalopod line before they branched into 8-armed octopuses and 10-limbed squids. This is a very ancient form. There are fossils from 200 million years ago that are identical, at least as far as we can tell, with this animal here. Vampyrotuthis lives down in very deep water where there's not much oxygen. You can see, though, that they have enormous eyes, and light and vision is very important to them. When a Vampyrotuthis is threatened by a serious threat, one of the first things it does is to throw its arms up over its body. And the arms are lined with little cirri, little fingers. But the animal changes its appearance from what we just saw to something that looks like this. That's part of the process of deterring a predator. Next, and this is something else we discovered, the tips of their arms have light organs on them. All of the netcot specimens that have been collected for 100 years before we saw them in their own habitat, it had the armpits broken off. They're very fragile. But it turns out that there are light organs in the arm tips. And not only can they light up, but they can also spew out a luminous fluid. So when the animal is threatened, it goes into this pineapple posture, turns on the lights at its arm tips, and surrounds itself with a cloud of twinkling luminescence. And we believe that the function of that is to provide a very distracting light display that confuses and makes a predator think it's getting into something far bigger, far more perplexing than a simple little Vampyrotuthis to eat. It must work because they've been around for 200 million years. Here's another form of bioluminescence. Remember Baroe, the tenophore that ate the other little tenophore? This is the light pattern they produce. But Baroe are blind, and we had no idea the function of this luminescence. It's extraordinary, a beautiful pattern, but that's one of the puzzles. What good is it? If it's there, it has to have some function. But as yet, since most of the predators of these animals appear to be other blind gelatinous animals, we can't imagine what the function is. So we're open to suggestions. If you have any good ideas, sing out, let me know, send me an email. Another way we see that light and vision are important is that animals down in the dimly lit waters use visual trickery. They try to trick predators into thinking they're something that they're not. There's a whole group of fishes, like this one, worms, larvaceans, a bunch of the animals that, for the most part, are elongate. They're relatively poor swimmers. They don't have any bioluminescence that they can use to trick prey. They don't have sharp teeth. They don't swim fast. Instead, when a predator, a visually cued predator like a fish or a squid, comes by, they throw themselves into a circle and just hang there. In that very dim light where there are really only shadows and shapes available, this looks for all the world like a jellyfish. So these animals are mimicking jellyfish in order to deter predators. If you think about it, a fish is a pretty appealing meal, lots of condensed nutrients in those muscles, and well worth the effort of consuming them. But a jellyfish, they're mostly water, there's not a lot of nutrition there, and they have all those nasty stinging cells. This is probably a good deterrent, and we believe that it's a case of classical mimicry. And it only happens in waters where the lights are very dim. If you go down deeper where there's no sunlight available, the animals don't do this trick. If you go up into well-lit waters above, they don't do it. But down where it's really dim, this kind of visual trickery is common. Another kind of visual trickery is the way that squids use ink. One of our graduate students, Stephanie Bush, began to investigate the numbers of different kinds of ink release patterns that she saw in the different kinds of squids that we were studying. And it turns out that they produce long streaks, they produce blobs, they make big clouds. There are a number of different varieties of patterns, and they use them in different situations. Each species has two or three that they most commonly use of the five or six that we see distributed across the range of squid species we work with. And different behaviors, different threat situations call for different kinds of ink utilization. Pseudomorphs, or fake bodies, is one of the ways that squid use ink. They try to leave a puff of ink that's sort of the same size and shape as their body, or maybe two or three or four or five of them, so that a predator isn't sure which one's the squid, which one's the ink. And not surprisingly, long, skinny squid leave long, skinny pseudomorphs, and little short, blobby squids make little short, blobby pseudomorphs. Some squids make big clouds of ink and then hide inside it. Others will make a long trail of ink that looks like a siphonophore, and then they'll hide behind the siphonophore with all those nasty stinging cells on its tentacles. So again, visual trickery in these dimly lit waters is quite common. We see amazing adaptations for animals to be able to use what light is available. This is a little squid that we came upon on our way to Hawaii years ago, diving the ROV across the Pacific. I had always thought that squid were more or less like fish, and they had one eye that looked out this way and one eye that looked out that way, and that's all you got. Well, as we approached this little squid, it began to bring its eyes together and to stare at us as we were moving in on it. We realized that doing that gave it binocular vision. It had an overlap of the visual fields, and it could judge distance and see us far better and reckon our distance and approach to it as we got there. It wasn't until we could look at a live squid in its own habitat before we realized that they had that capability. Okay. This fish is really weird. It has this tiny little hoochie mouth down here. Those two dark things are its nostrils. The two green spheres are the lenses of its eyes. And each eye, or each lens, sits on top a cylindrical tube. And the retina is at the bottom of the tube, looking up. You can see that the two eyes are side by side, and so their visual field overlaps. And they have great depth perception. They can recognize how close a target is to them. And these animals were not unknown. They were first discovered in 1939. And they had always been caught in nets. And I even caught a couple myself. And it always bothered me that that animal can't see what it's eating. The visual field of the eyes does not include the mouth. Well, there are a lot of things like that out there that you just can't figure out. It's not intuitive, it's not obvious until you move along. Finally, we came upon one of these guys with the ROV. And we saw first, it looks very different. There's that canopy, that clear shield over the top of the eyes. That never survives being caught in a net. And so the eyes were always exposed. And as we flew up on this guy and watched, it moved its eyes. Instead of looking up, it went down like that. And then back up again. I thought, oh! Then we started looking in the literature and found out that these animals eat a wide variety of prey. Little shrimps, little gelatinous animals, small worms, almost everything that swims around down there that's small. But one thing that was consistently present in the stomach contents of animals that we examined and that were reported in the literature were siphonophore tentacles. And so we watched and we figured it out. These animals swim along underneath one of those long siphonophores with the eyes looking up. The fishes swim along like this. It spots something stuck in the tentacles of the siphonophore. It pivots the body up, steals the food, pivots back down, and swims along to the next item in the smorgasbord. That's supposed to be a video, but you can go on Mabari's YouTube page and see us try to capture this animal, and it eludes us, much to the delight all of the people who comment on YouTube. Remarkable development of eyes is common. This is an owlfish. You can see how much of the head that eye occupies. This is an animal called a snipe eel. It captures prey, and it feeds exclusively on shrimp that have really long antennae. And the snipe eel moves this beak through the water and entangles the tentacles of the shrimp that it feeds on. And as it turns out, the microstructure of that beak is like half of Velcro, and it exactly matches, it's an exact counterpart to the microstructure of the surface of the antennae, so that when the antennae touch the beak, it's like Velcro. And yet vision, clearly, for both of these animals is really important if you consider the amount of effort, the amount of evolutionary currency, if you will, that has been invested in developing those enormous eyes. Oops, I keep doing that. This is Octopatuthis, another squid that we've been working on. And what we've discovered is that, again, in these dimly lit waters, animals are communicating with each other. not just with predators and prey, but with each other. Octopatuthis has luminous tips to its arms. It has a broad range of behaviors and postures. And Stephanie Bush, our recent grad student, investigated this animal for her PhD thesis and found that there are a number of repeated patterns of coloration. The animal can go completely pale, it can go completely dark, you can put a pale circle around its eyes, you can put stripes on its fins, it can put stripes on its body, it can do spots, it can do streaks. It has a whole range of coloration patterns that it can display. Well, that's not too surprising. We know that's the case with octopuses and cuttlefish and other animals that you can see right out here in the aquarium. But then this is down in deep water where there isn't much light. Stephanie also determined that there are a specific set of postures that the animal will adopt. And these patterns are repeated again and again and again. It'll hold the arms together. It can hold the arms splayed out. It'll hold the arms up over the head. It'll fold the fins. It'll have the fins spread out. And the different postures, again, repeated again and again, are used in conjunction with the different color patterns. In addition to that, there's luminescence. The animal can show all of the arm tips illuminated. It can increase the density of these color patches and reduce the amount of light, or it can cut it off entirely. So it can play with the amount and type of light produced by each arm tip. Plus, it's also capable of a half a dozen different ink patterns. So you and all of these different expressions, if you will, are used in conjunction with each other. And there are behavioral sequences that the animals go through that incorporate different elements of these kinds of expression. So Stephanie prepared an ethogram, a menu, if you will, of all the different ways that this animal can express itself, if you will, and then began to associate them with different behavior patterns. And it was extraordinary, first time anybody had ever done that for a deep sea animal. And when she was done, we realized that these are all elements of what might be a language. We can see what these animals are expressing. You just don't know what it means yet. But it was a tremendous awakening for us to realize that these are elements of communicative language and that there is communication going on in deep water, far more complex, far more complicated and involved than we ever imagined. Okay, I gotta crank it up. We've learned a great deal about reproduction. For centuries, people believed that squids exhibited no parental care. They either laid their egg cases on the bottom and let them grow up and hatch, or they produced a floating egg case and let that go. And the eggs hatched and or developed and hatched until we came upon this squid holding a large tubular sheet of eggs. It turns out that parental care is indeed part of the life cycle of a number of squids. We've discovered several more that brood their eggs. They hold the eggs in their arms until they develop and hatch. They go down into deep water away from predators. They move their arms back and forth to aerate the eggs, and they protect them, in this case, for as long as 9 months. We've also found some peculiar reproductive traits. this is Octopatuthis again. And it turns out that one evidence of reproduction, of mating in these squids, is that males attach little packets of sperm called spermatangia to the females, and the females then collect the spermatangia and either use them to fertilize eggs right away, or they tuck them away someplace and keep them until they're ready. But what we began to notice is that males were just as likely to have spermatangia attached to them as females. And we did some genetic analyses, and no, they weren't from the same individual. And what we came to realize is that opportunities to reproduce in this deep, dark habitat are probably few and far between. And these are solitary animals. They don't live in schools or groups. And so the reproductive strategy is that the male, Octopatuthis, deposits sperm on any member of the same species that it encounters down there in the dark. Male, female, doesn't matter. It's a different sort of reproductive approach than people had imagined. But again, it's the sort of thing you can learn if you enter the habitat. Okay, I'm going to have to speed up. Things are changing in the ocean. You all know that. And some of the consequences are remarkable. This is Dasyticus gigas, the Humboldt squid that has invaded the California coast. They are big, pugnacious animals that go anywhere they like and eat anything they like. We see them in great abundance from the ROVs, and we've been able to work on their behavior pattern. They too use ink like many other animals do. Here's one who's creating a cloud and hiding in it. Others are just squirting through. Now, this just shows that there were no Humboldt squid in Monterey Bay until the El Nino of 1997-98. Then they dropped off. Then they came back in 2002. Those are the red lines coming down from the top of the graph. The gray lines, or everything under the gray curve, is the abundance of hake. Hake are the most important ground fish fishery, the most important commercial ground fish fishery off the western coast of North America. The Dasyticus came to Monterey Bay. They clobbered the hake for the 2 years they were resident in 97-98. When they left, the hake started coming back. Then the squid came back again and clobbered the hake, and the hake have not yet recovered. What's going on? We think this. The home ground of these squid is in the eastern tropical Pacific, down around the Gulf of California and further south. They like warm water. They also do very well in water with low oxygen. These squid compete with tuna and billfishes for the same kind of food. And tuna and billfishes eat baby squid. So what's happened in recent years is that the temperature of the ocean is getting warmer. There's less oxygen in it. We have removed most of the big tunas and billfish, so the competition for food has decreased for the squid. And the predation on the young squid has also dropped off. What's happened is that population exploded, and it moved north and south. The same effects that we've seen off California have happened in off Peru and Chile, and their hake populations have been clobbered too. Now that the hake are gone, the squid are eating salmon, they're eating market squid, anything they like. And so there's pretty good evidence that the changes taking place in the ocean have led to a remarkable range expansion and and an invasion, if you will. All right, I'm going to have to go through this very quickly. We profile the oceanic water column. On the left here is depth from the surface down to 3,500 meters. And the green line there is the amount of oxygen in the water. Almost nothing over here at this end. More oxygen saturation up to the surface over there. Off the coast of California, at about 600 meters, 700 meters depth, is the core of what we call the oxygen minimum zone. It's a depth layer in the ocean where there is very, very little oxygen. What we're seeing is that that layer is expanding. It's getting bigger in the vertical plane. the top of the oxygen minimum zone is going up towards the surface, and the bottom of the oxygen minimum zone is going down towards the bottom. That's having a pronounced effect on certain animals. This little shrimp, I think you can see it, that's the shrimp that the snipe eel likes to eat. The red line here is the top of the oxygen minimum zone, and from 1996 until 2011, you can see that it's moving upwards. It's changed, it moved up about 80 meters. And the blue line is the center of distribution of that little shrimp. As the oxygen minimum zone expands, it's pushing the shrimp up closer to the surface. The consequences are that as that shrimp moves up into shallower water where there's more light, it's more vulnerable to visually cued predators. Warmer water means that its metabolic rate has to be higher. And it's being separated from the majority of animals that it typically lives with. We're seeing that the whole community is fragmented because not every species is affected the same way. Here are those larvaceans, the ones that build the big houses. They too are being pushed up towards the surface. Blue line is the animals, red line is the expanding oxygen minimum zone. The closer they get to the surface, the smaller are the houses they build, because the closer you get to the surface, the more eddies and currents there are. So they can't build those big houses because they'll be torn up by the water. So they build smaller houses, and that means there's less food getting to the deep sea floor because they sink more slowly, they can be degraded by bacteria, and there is a measurable decrease in the amount of food getting to the deep sea floor. One more animal, you remember that siphonophore. It's being pushed down. The red line is the bottom of the oxygen minimum zone, and it's going down. And the blue line is the distribution of these siphonophores. They're being pushed down by the change in oxygen. They're going further from the base of the food chain. They're being separated from animals that they typically occur with. Now, you can't go into a habitat like this without finding new animals all the time. We've been doing it for 24 years, and we're still finding new animals, things that we've never seen before. That's Tiburonia, a big medusa that we described. This is a tenophore that we described. There's an undescribed siphonophore there and another medusa. When we come across a new animal, we're sitting in the control room and we have headsets on and we're talking back and forth. But the chief scientist has a microphone that feeds onto the audio track of the videotape, because we record everything. And when we come across something we've never seen before, we usually give it some kind of a name, because everything that we say on the videotape, well, everything except the scurrilous comments about our colleagues and jokes in poor taste and that sort of stuff. Everything scientific that we say is recorded and put into a database. And we need to have a handle for an animal that we don't recognize. Well, this came up, and well, it's a pig's butt. It turned out to be a remarkable animal that indeed no one had ever seen before. And our grad student, Karen Osborne, did the molecular work, did the morphological work, wrote a beautiful paper describing this new animal, which she named Pugaporcinus, which is pig butt. We were very proud. And then she got a cover shot on the Valentine's Day issue of the Biological Bulletin. We were thrilled beyond measure. Here's another one. I'll not belabor this one. Doliolids are filter feeders. Every other doliolid we've ever seen is typically barrel-shaped. They have a bunch of filters inside. They pass water through and feed on the particles that are trapped. We came across this animal. It was pulsing, and it looked like a medusa, a jellyfish. It had a velum. It had many of the structures you associate with jellyfish, and it was a predator. It ate copepods, little crustaceans. Well, it turns out that down in deep water where this animal moved, the only way to make a living is to become a carnivore. And so it changed its basic body shape to that resembling the archetypical predator, gelatinous predator before, the Medusa. And this one, again, all the other known doliolids in the world are grazers. They feed on particles. But this one became a carnivore. And so we named it Sedusa because it fooled us. We thought it was a Medusa. And Bostagranis means the cow that became a tiger. Now, here's another one. This is a chain of doliolids that turns out to have a symbiotic polyp attached to it. This is a symbiotic relationship wherein the polyp steals food from the filters of the doliolid. And we thought, but what? How can this be a symbiosis? The polyp clearly is the winner here. It gets free food. It's up off the bottom where all the polyp eaters like to exist. What does the doliolid, which occurs in these long chains, get out of this? Well, as we looked closer, we discovered that the polyps, which look like little palm trees, stalks, ball, and tentacles, reproduce asexually. And what happens is the polyp bends over and one tentacle will go out and touch the body of the doliolid and attach. And then it'll separate from the ball of the polyp. And then that tentacle will walk like an inchworm along the body of the animal to the next one in the chain. And it'll move out to this position on that animal and it will form a polyp. And then it will send out a tentacle that walks like an inchworm to the next one in the chain until all of the doliolids in the chain have a little polyp on their front porch, if you will. And there were many more tentacles looking for a home than there are individual doliolids in the chain. And so the whole chain is covered with these tentacles that have stinging cells. So the advantage to the doliolid to make it a real symbiotic relationship is that it gets protection from predators by all of these tentacles that have grown up from the hitchhikers. Okay, here are a couple of really silly looking animals that don't have names. So we call this one the Rastafarian squid for obvious reasons. Planktotuthis, the video isn't working. Oh, there it goes. It has an incredibly long tail with all of this ornate stuff on it. We have an intern working in our lab this summer who believes that the squid is trying to look like a siphonophore and that it's a case of mimicry, avoiding predation by taking that approach, looking like something that's unpalatable. Okay, almost done. This is a really weird critter. We came upon this, and I had six of the best invertebrate zoologists in the world in my control room. And this came up on the screen, and everybody went, uh-oh. We couldn't even put it in a phylum. And it really puzzled us. As it turns out, this is a bathypelagic nudibranch. Nudibranchs are those colorful little shell-less snails that you see in the tanks out. That live in shallow water. But it turns out that one of them has moved into very deep water and evolved into an entirely new configuration. We did the morphology and we did the genetics. There's no question. This is a nudibranch. But it's a new species, a new genus, and a new family. It's completely unprecedented. Okay. I'm done. I'll be happy to answer questions.